Today in conversation with Javad Alipour, playwright, activist, and director. This is We Are What We Speak. I'm Aaliyah. I'm here with a fantastic guest who's only around for a few days in Ann Arbor, so I'm super lucky to have been able to snag a few moments. Playwright, activist, artist, artistic director of Javad Alipour Company, which is also who you are.
Thank you. Yeah, I am a theatre maker, occasional film and screen bod, writer, director, occasionally performer, only ever really if I've written something and there's kind of a dramaturgical reason for me to be in it. I'm a very political person, and my work is very political, and there's a different part of my life in which I write about politics or talk about politics or try and change things in politics, a lot of which is driven by anti-racist stuff in the UK, especially galvanized by the uptick in anti-immigrant racism that happened after the Brexit referendum, but also Middle Eastern solidarity stuff. I've got part of my family, so half my heritage on my father's side is from Iran. I speak Persian, I'm just bilingual, that's a big part of who I am. Like, I've got a very Iranian name. I look the way I do. My mum's white and English. And so I've also been involved in like doing solidarity work around the struggle for democracy in Iran and to a lesser extent, Syria, the struggle there. So yeah, I am the artistic director of the Javad Alipour Company, which I will often joke is not the most imaginative name anyone's ever given a theatre company, but it does what it says on the tin, right? Like there is a, you know, a small team. I'm kind of artistic director, chief exec of it. And there's some folks who work with me to make kind of, I hope, formally adventurous, complex, but still fun stuff about international political questions.
I have so many questions. One thing that we always, always want to talk about with our guests is their childhood. So part of this mission is to document people's experiences with language from really, really young, as far back as they can remember to like today. So we can sort of across time chart perceptions from when they were younger and when did they start noticing, and then how do those compare to today? And so with that being said, can you talk a little bit about how you were taught to think about language when you were younger? And these could be explicit or implicit messages, right? So when you were younger, what were you being taught to understand about language?
I definitely, I grew up bilingual. So my father always spoke to me in Persian and my mum always spoke to me in English. And I grew up in a sort of medium-sized city in Northern England, which is very typical of a strip of cities across Northern Europe that in the West probably starts in, I don't know, maybe Belfast, definitely Liverpool, and goes right the way across the UK and then into continental Europe. And it's those kinds of cities that used to be industrial hearts of various empires, and used to be very, very rich. And are now, if you like, Europe's Rust Belt, do you know what I mean? Europe's Rust Belt. So they tend to be, they tend to look a little bit more Victorian than the American Rust Belt. They tend to be slightly smaller cities than places like Detroit, but they do tend to be very ethnically, you could say, diverse, or have quite a lot of ethnic minorities in them. So, and the big ethnic minorities across that strip would often be ethnic minorities from the Muslim world. So in the town I grew up, there was a lot of people from Pakistani, with Pakistani heritage, Bangladeshi heritage, to a lesser extent Indian. Once you get into France, it's people with Algerian and Moroccan heritage. And then, in, you know, in Germany, it's people with Turkish heritage and so on. So I grew up in a city where actually it is a kind of relatively poor working class, you could say, Northern European city, but a cosmopolitan one, like with like literally dozens of languages spoken in it, you know. I think that my parents will tell a story about there weren't that many Iranians. There was quite a lot of other quote unquote brown people, but there weren't that many Iranians. And so my parents will tell a story about me and my sisters thinking that Persian was a special secret code we just spoke with our dad. Do you know what I mean? Which is kind of cute and nice and ha ha ha. But then one of my earliest memories is being in what we'd call primary school, like first school, what we call that, junior school, and me learning to write Persian over the summer. You know what I mean? And obviously, I kind of remember, which in English you write from left to right, don't you? In Persian, you write from right to left. And I remember going to school, and I don't remember this actual thing, but I remember the things that happened around it. And I was went into school, and I was doing some kind of a spelling thing or whatever, you know, some kind of writing exercise. And I wrote an entire sort of side of paper the wrong way around in English. And so my parents were called in for like a crisis meeting or something like this with like the teachers. And this white teacher, who I think I would probably imagine felt she had the best interest of everyone at heart, basically told my parents that they shouldn't bring up their children bilingual because it would mean they'd never speak English well enough. And I remember my parents hitting the roof about that. And I remember there being me being taken out of class and there being this whole to do. Now, clearly that's racist nonsense, right? Like, and it's also clearly true that, like, if you come from a aristocratic English background and you grow up somewhere in the south of France and your parents bring you up speaking French and English, no one's ever going to say it's important that you focus on English. But if you're a Pakistani migrant, or you know, if you have the, and I remember the politics of that stuff working out in lots of different ways, you know, like some people with minority backgrounds, I remember feeling funny about it when I was a kid, but then I remember growing into it and really being proud of stuff, do you know what I mean? And that changing for me in lots of different ways. Before I was an artist, I was what in England we'd call a youth and community worker. I always loved coming to this part of the world because my first sort of like artistic love before theatre was techno and house music. So I spent most of my early 20s DJing techno and house music and earning a living by being a youth and community worker. And I remember being in a youth centre working with, you know, what you might call sort of like quite hard end young people. Do you know what I mean? People have been young people have been through some stuff. I worked, I did some bits of work at a youth centre where part of it was what in England you'd call a pupil referral unit, which is like your last gasp, last station stop before jail sort of a thing. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
And that was disproportionately young people with South Asian heritage, disproportionately Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. We know why that's disproportionately the way it is. You know, I'm sorry, I'm going to say that to you. And I remember sometimes staff members, people would speak Urdu, let's say, or Punjabi. And sometimes from white staff members, there'd be view, you know, there'd be something would be said, worst effect of, you're not allowed to speak, and this would be the phrase, your own language here. And by this stage, I'm in my 20s and I've got, you know, 2 degrees. So I knew, I quite confidently tear a strip off these people, which we mainly with words to the effect of, how dare you use the phrase your own language? Like, which is a funny little callback to thinking it was a secret code with my dad, actually, because you're like, you know, if you're talking about Urdu or Punjabi, you're talking about a language spoken by like 300 million people.
It's so interesting.
200 year history of poetry. I'm just like, get back in your box, man. Like, I don't know what you think this is. But sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was just reacting just because the fact that that seems to be a callback from that moment in childhood, mm-hmm. It seems to stand throughout time, despite the fact that you were getting older and older. I mean, you were introduced to this idea of linguistic prestige pretty early, even knowing, I mean, maybe you understood that later, but like, depending on the language you spoke, it would be treated as a crisis. And I would commend your parents for not giving into that, because this is also something that happens in the United States. I find that most often it's with like English and Spanish. But of course there's a bunch of languages it could happen and does happen with. I know in, you know, Michigan, Dearborn is the second largest population speaking Arabic, right? And so this ideology still persists to this day, this idea of don't teach them that, because there's this perception of a handicap being introduced to the child. And some parents go for it. Some parents embrace that in attempt to assimilate. And others, I think, embrace this idea that no. Yeah. This is a part of who we are, right? So I just wanted to react to what you were saying. Yeah. And the fact that you stood up for those kids, because that's the other element that stands out to me, is that you said something which helps introduce a different kind of narrative to those young lives.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's something that means a lot to me. The idea of linguistic prestige is like super interesting. Now, I'm not a linguist. I think I am in many ways a recovering philosophy postgraduate. That's what I did my master's in. I'm not a linguist, so I don't know the sort of technicalities of it, but when you're talking about linguistic prestige, like speaking English and Persian, what's interesting is there's like a kind of different kind of prestige that Persian has. So growing up, as I was saying, in a city where there's a lot of people of Pakistani and Bangladeshi heritage, like those, most of those folks I grew up with didn't speak Persian, but their parents or grandparents who'd emigrated in the immediate post-colonial period, they had an idea of Persian as a prestige language, because of course it was the language of the last great Muslim empire in India, the Mughals, right? Their court language was Persian. So there's an idea of it. So there's like, that, yeah, there's quite an interesting thing from a kind of, to be honest with you, quite parochial, like small-minded, white, doesn't know anything about the world point of view. There's like a, oh, well, that's kind of a working class and quote-unquote brown language or whatever. But like, there's a whole other world and history in which Persian is this incredibly prestigious literary language, which actually my Iranian grandmother didn't speak that well, because the ethnic minority within Iran she came from, do you see what I'm saying? Like the ethnic minority, she came,
yeah,
she was like a peasant and didn't really go to school properly and came from an ethnic minority where they actually spoke a dialect of Turkish. But because my dad went to school and university, you know, he speaks the prestigious literary language. So yeah, man, like there's, you know, it's complicated, right?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of commentary from comedians who bring some of that up when they like encounter Americans or more specifically people who don't know, they bring out this reality that like to y'all it sounds all the same, but to us there's these nuances and these complexities that you just, it just goes over your head, and it's, yeah, it's frustrating when that nuance actually gets flattened for people. So yeah, this is all really, really amazing. I actually want to shift to thinking a little bit about your work, because you tackle lots of political subjects. I'd be really interested to know how you handle language in your work. And I do mean more specifically than like, you're right. I mean, how does language show up, and how do you explicitly deal and specifically deal with language?
I think I'm a, you know, I am, I take seriously being a writer. Most of my work is made in a kind of, let's say, contemporary theatre sort of model. So like it is a way of making theatre which is in a tradition which owes to people like, let's say, the Worcester Group and the Living Theatre and Complicity. And I don't know if those theatre companies, you know, mean something to folks. They certainly mean something to me. And there would be people who would... experimenting and getting together and throwing ideas around and seeing where the metaphor is. That's how the work comes. And that's, you know, we play a lot with technology. When I talk about the work being fun, you know, we play I hope we upend people's expectation of what happens when you come to the theater. I'm a big believer in, you know, in our work, like we break one big rule of how theater is supposed to work in the first 5 minutes, and then there's a sense in the room that anything could happen. Do you know what I mean? And that's, you can go take people on the journey then. Now, when I was talking about those kinds of companies, your Living Theatres, your Worcester Groups, your Complicities in England, your International Institute of Political Murder, which is this amazing, you know, Belgian company. Like that kind of devising, like sometimes, and that's not true of those who are the best companies in that scene, but sometimes that, what you might call more contemporary theatre, sometimes like the literary part of theatre, the writing, capital W writing thing, is not taken as seriously as it is in more traditional ways of making theatre, you know, where like a writer is commissioned and they sit and write a play. And I think one of the things that happens in my work, I should say our work, the work that the company does, is that we really do take writing seriously. So like, for instance, this show that's here in Ann Arbor at the minute was co-written by me and an amazing English playwright called Chris Thorpe. We've been working together in different ways for a couple of years now. And we are both, like, we will not let it go until it's the right turn of phrase. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense to you? And so I really believe in writing in that sense. So when you come see our work, I hope there's a sense of a flow to it, and there's a sense that it often plays with the idea of you arriving in a theater and me just turning up to tell you something, and things flow from there. But the economy of the words that are chosen and the way that turns of phrase pay off other places and the way the form of the show is mirrored by the form of the writing. So for instance, we wrote this, you know, we had this show that was touring quite a lot in lockdown called Rich Kids, A History of Shopping Malls in Tehran, that was about the obnoxious lifestyles of the kids of the dictators in that part of the world. Part of the way the show works was it talked you through the Instagram account of a fictionalized version of a kid who is like part of the, he's from Iran, but part of the international ultra elite. Now, if you've ever been on Instagram, you'll know that if you click on someone's profile, the first picture it'll take you to is the one like from now. And as you scroll down, you go further into the past, right? That's how Instagram works. So we wrote that show backwards. So at the top of the show, you see the end of the story. And you go back down into what its roots are. Do you know what I mean? In this show, Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, that's playing at the Arthur Miller Theatre this week as we're recording, you know, at part of the thing, it's kind of about post-colonial theory. It's kind of about internet culture. And it's kind of about the murder of this Iranian pop star. So the way there's a murder mystery podcast that happens live through the show and the way that's written in the form of that writing is some of the stuff we're trying to say about how cultures misunderstand each other because of power dynamics.
Yeah. I mean, proud of coming in here is also that this is this interconnected world. Certainly we're more connected than we have been in the past. Technology plays a really big part of that. And so I'm interested more in some of your process. The mechanism of theater, I'm a techie at heart. I started in a theater. So theater definitely has a near and dear part of like my identity and my background. I'm super interested in hearing you talk more about using theater to talk about things in a really specific way and what it actually takes to bring all those elements together, right? Not just the writing, but also the soundscape, also the lighting design, all of those things tell part of the story. And I'm interested in you just talking a little bit more about how you leverage this particular method versus photography, for example, versus filmmaking to say the things you want to say in the way you want to say them.
That's a really good question. I mean, for me, what I'd say is like that theater has something really special it can do, especially for political theater, that I don't think any other form can do in the same way. And the thing that theatre has is that it really, really, in its foundations, it basically relies on people suspending disbelief, right? In a very specific way. And it relies on them suspending disbelief whilst actual real people are physically there. So it has a very complicated structure of relationship to the truth. Now, I spoke about being a political artist, but having a part of my life which is more, let's say, political journalist or political activist. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really flatter myself with it. I've got journalist friends who are real journalists. I occasionally write opinion pieces. Do you know what I mean? It's not the real deal, let's say. But in any case, so if I know the answer to something about a political question, I'm not going to make a show about it. I don't make art about it. If I know the answer, I'm going to write 500 words on it and try and get it placed somewhere. Or I'm going to knock on your door and ask you to vote a certain way in an election. Or I'm going to encourage you to do something. If I don't know the answer to something, if I have a question that I'm trying to explore, if I think there's something knotty and complicated that people don't think about enough but should think about more, but I don't want to tell them what to think. I want them to have the same fucking problem. Sorry, can I swear a little bit? I want them to have the same problem following them around that I've got following me around, that I think people should have following them around. Then I might make a show about it. What the reason theatre is important to that is because of that structure of belief. There is, especially on the liberal or left side of politics, I think, a naive and what you could call Whiggish view of political change. Where like the idea is, if I convince enough individual people, either through really doing my best not to get angry and convincing them and taking them on a journey, or through just being really angry and passionate and somehow that'll cut through. If I convince enough individual people, then the world will change. And it just seems to me that's not how the world works. Do you know what I mean? Because people's relationship to truth and belief and big ideas is much more complicated than that. And that's why we end up stuck. So Rich Kids, in a way, one of the things that Rich Kids, History of Shopping Malls in Tehran ended up being about was like the feeling that we all know what the big issues with climate change are, but we all feel stuck. Do you know what I mean? So we're exploring that feeling of stuckness. This show, Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, is about the feeling of the world encroaching and getting tighter and tighter, and people saying, but how am I supposed to deal with what's going on in Palestine and what's going on with Iran and what's going on with Ukraine? And what this show isn't about is an answer to that. It's an exploration of that feeling that hopefully gives you some tools and jokes and visual images that'll be productive in your mind in the future when you're engaging with that. Do you know what I mean? And the reason theatre can do that is because of that complex structure of belief. So I always go back to properly old school English theatre person example. The first thing that happens in Henry V is the chorus turns up, right? And what does the chorus say? I mean, I can't quote it. I should be able to quote it, but I can't. The chorus turns up and he does the what they call the apology, doesn't he? And the apology, yes. The structure of the apology is he says, look, we are but actors. Do you know what I mean? We're about to play out one of the most famous battles in English history. We're going to do, whether it's Agincourt or whatever. And we're going to say horses are running across this stage. And we're going to say a king is fighting another king. They won't be doing. They'll just be actors and they'll just be props. But you should imagine the king and you should imagine the horses. And the Greeks do the same thing, right? You know, the Greeks are forever going, like if you read the oldest translations of the Greek text, the Greeks are going, this is what you need to imagine. And so there's a slipperiness, there's a playfulness, which I think reflects the very real structure of how people believe things about the world.
Yeah, well, my mind is, I'm like going there. And I like that callback to Henry V. So this also leads me to wanting to know more, and some things I can assume, but I don't really want to, right? So when you sit down and you're writing something, who are you writing to or speaking about? I feel like I read somewhere that someone described you as a playwright who writes with and for communities that don't usually like engage in the arts. And so when you're doing these pieces, I think back to like Ousmane Sembène, who his work was solely for Senegalese people. He didn't even like his work being translated. Yeah. Who do you write for and who do you want to engage with your stories and your questions?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that I don't usually sit down on my own to write. I do some of that stuff, right? But my best work and the place where I really feel like I'm doing my work is when I'm in a rehearsal room and things are happening around me and I'm getting stuff to happen, okay. Suggest things. And I go, okay, give me half an hour. I'm going to write that. Do you know what I mean? I tend to collaboration is a big part of what we do, which is why I run a company. In the shows I've made over the past few years, I've either co-written them and directed them or I've co-directed them and written them. Do you know what I mean? So there's a very basic fluid relationship there. In terms of who I'm writing for, I mean, look, part of who I'm writing, my honest response to that is that like, I think that there is a really interesting missing audience from contemporary art. And the first way I'm going to define them, and this is true, I think, in the US, in the UK, in Europe, in Australia, finely grained term, in the richer countries in the world, right? There is a missing audience where I see people my age and a bit younger. So like from older millennials down a little bit, there's an audience of people. And me and you are artists, right? And we have a certain view and we, you know, we're kind of a minority in a way. Because there's that generation where I see people who are like, care about politics, care about all kinds of arts and culture, you know, everything from, you know, probably not the poorest people of that generation, certainly educated quite well, better than generations previously. And actually, when you get to the cities, kind of ethnically diverse, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think about not, you know, some cities in this country, but certainly Manchester, certainly Liverpool, certainly Frankfurt, certainly Sydney. And there being this section of people who are like frustrated at the way the world's going, kind of political, kind of connected to art and culture in the broad sense, meaning from going to a restaurant opening to like watching cult films, but they're not connecting as much as I think they should do with stuff like theatre and dance and various other kinds of art. And so one of the groups of audience that we really try and dig into is that audience. Do you know what I mean? There's other audiences we get who are kind of like the audiences who drink up loads of political theater anyway. And that's different audiences at different places, right? Like sitting down and playing for a week in or 2 weeks in Manchester is a different, it's a slightly different kettle of fish to like 3 weeks in London or a couple of weeks at an international festival. Do you know what I mean? But certainly that would be a way to describe where my company thinks about the audience we're trying to build as opposed to the people who immediately come. I'd say that one part of that, one thing that often comes up in conversations with me, you gave that example, which is a very appropriate one. I'm not trying to say that there's certain things I will say where I'll go, this is right. And I think, and I'll fight for this, I'll bat for this. Do you know what I mean? This is just my vibe, right? And my vibe is I do not want to assume that my audience is white people. Do you know what I mean? And that sounds like a really chill and relaxed thing to say, but I see quite a lot of work by artists of color where a big part of, even when it's kind of radical, it's still centering that the audience is all white people. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like I see some punches that are being landed only really land if you're white. Do you know what I mean? And this is why I'm not saying everyone has to do it. I'm saying this is my way of doing what I'm trying to do, is like, it's not that the way I want to... Yeah, like I want to assume that that's not the entirety of my audience. Do you know what I mean? And actually, if there are, I mean, we made this show called The Believers Are But Brothers, which was about young men who join ISIS or the alt-right and how they get radicalized online. And we actually played a lot of fun and games with, there is a white audience in England who would see someone with my name, with my kind of vibe from the place I'm from, and they'd go, okay, some guy who is a bit Muslim is going to explain to us why Muslim boys do this thing. Do you know what I mean? And actually a ton of the show was sending that up. Do you know what I mean? But I hope what we were asking anyone who came to the theater with that expectation, I hope we were making them keep up as opposed to assuming that my job was to speak to them. Do you know what I mean? Like, just to be really clear, that was a really personal answer. That's certainly not me. Everyone has to make the work they do, and they do it in different ways, right?
Yeah, there was a couple of follow-ups that I wanted, but this, I wanted to touch a little bit on the play that you just talked about, because I'm interested in like a hypothetical when you talk about the radicalization and that story, which, first of all, one thing that we are looking at this show is this intersection between language and technology. And there were, you know, a series of stories coming out as artificial intelligence becomes a bigger, bigger, bigger conversation, and how a series of chatbots, you know, they're trained on human language models, right? And so how you train them is you feed them lots of data, and usually they use things like Reddit, Facebook, right? And so there were a couple of stories that came out where these were broken. These chatbots were essentially broken, quote unquote broken, very quickly, because they devolved into these machines that were reproducing lots of hate speech and really bigoted speech. And it was this moment of like, oh, it's reproducing what was fed into it, what humans put into it, right? And so I'd be interested in, would you ever write something around that intersection of language and technology, more specifically thinking about how people become radicalized and the technology, the artificial technology that we create ourselves?
I mean, well, the Believers Are But Brothers, in a way, if I was to slightly obnoxiously sum up what that show was about, it was, you know, it opened in 2017 when ISIS's territorial control in Syria and Iraq was at its height, right? And it struck me that there was quite an Islamophobic and, let's call it what it is, racist discussion of young guys from the West joining ISIS or blowing themselves up in whatever conditions they blew themselves up in, where the kind of Islamophobic way of phrasing it, people say, what's the problem with young Muslim men? And the eye-wateringly obvious point that struck me was that this was at the same time as like the beginnings of the rise of like the men's rights movement and the alt-right, and like a whole package of things that were like galvanizing a certain kind of mainly but not only white boy in the United States. So my point, my kind of, in a way, the fun we were having that show of going, it's not what's the problem with young Muslim men, it's what's the problem with young men, right? do you know what I mean? Like, it's the problem with like, guys, chill out, do you know what I mean? It's all right. Like, and And so I spent a lot of time like researching, like this was the very, very, so before we, I started writing it before Trump won that election, right? And so I sort of saw this group of young men who I first came across on places like Reddit when they were involved, they would be getting radicalized by stuff like Gamergate. If you know about Gamergate, Brilliant. Then we don't need to go into it. Brilliant. I always feel like it's one of those things where either people have heard of it or they haven't, and you describe it and you sound insane. Do you know what I mean? And I was seeing them cohere into some stuff that was going to become kind of the beginnings of Proud Boys and that kind of stuff, right? Saying kind of Venn diagrams of people. And I kicked around on, basically at the time, there was people on Twitter who were claiming to be European Muslims who'd gone to join ISIS. Many men, some women. Now, whether they had done it, they were secret policemen acting as honey traps, or they were fantasists in their mother's basement, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? In any case, I remember one of the things that really galvanized the writing of that show and kind of got my hands on some stuff was, at the time, there was this so-called phenomenon of ISIS brides. Do you remember ISIS brides?
I do.
Young women, largely from poor African Muslim and Asian Muslim backgrounds in Europe, going to go become married jihadis in Syria. And the way that that was often phrased, that discussion was phrased by, you know, liberals in Europe, was they would say, "Well, what is going on, man? These women, like, who grow up in a kind of like freedom and like democracy in Europe, and this, like, how can they turn their back on like this sort of more feminist thing and then go live as kind of like slaves to these men in the East?" Now, here's the thing. There was a propaganda poster that was being passed around these young women that, so it's colored like a screenshot from Call of Duty, you know, that kind of like very rich pixel sort of thing. And it had this guy in it who I was called the Hollywood Jihadi. So he had like a beard, like a big beard, but like, you know, lovely, like really lovely, like well sort of kept beard, like a scar, but in a really hot way, absolutely jacked, just like, you know, 3D shoulders like this, kind of look like the beginning, like between like a real guy, a computer game guy, and someone from Game of Thrones, and this huge phallic assault rifle. And then the slogan around it, it had text on it, and it said, "Sisters, what kind of man do you want? Some flabby guy who works in an office who'll leave you as soon as someone younger and thinner walks past, or this brother who'll die for you." Now, so what's the offer that's going on to those young women? It's not leave behind freedom. It's what the offer is leave behind your drab, crap life in like a rainy part of Brussels and come to where people live, man. Come to Game of Thrones, come to Call of Duty, you know? So for me, that was that story I tried to tell about radicalization. For me, in a way, the way technology interacts with that, I think AI is a different question, but it's almost a spiritual thing. Do you know what I mean? You've got, for thousands of years, human beings have had religious movements and philosophies and ways of dreaming, which are about hating the body and about seeking to escape the confinement of like materiality in everyday life, you know, whether it's the Gnostics in kind of first century Palestine, or whether it's, you know, certain kind of like, you know, Hindu kind of shamans who are Hindu mystics who are like mortifying the body and stuff to try and get the spirit to escape. And it strikes me that like there is a way that we interact with technology that's part of that. I mean, if you step back for a second, one of the things that struck me about the ISIS thing was, so vastly more young men watch jihadi propaganda videos than ever go and join them or do anything. Do you know what I mean? So what's that saying to me? Well, it's saying to me, this image that sits on this like, you know, beautiful clean computer screen, like that's what's really going on for these people. It's not, because they're not then doing anything about it, right? You know, that's for most people, that's how it works. And so I think there's something about that feels like kind of like radicalization, and politically pulls the world further towards the right and that kind of barbarism and stuff. But really it's a very ancient thing. It's about a kind of Gnostic desire to leave behind the messiness of really living in a body and having to do everyday things and just wanting to escape into the more beautiful thing.
Okay, well, I need a an effects button because I didn't even think of it that way. I'm just like, mic drop. Wow. So yeah, first of all, thank you for taking me down this particular road, walking me through that really gave me a sense of not only what you're trying to say, but yeah, like that. I mean, it also makes a lot of sense that might be the reality of what's happening. The statistics are there regarding the viewership or the bringing in the information versus action taken afterwards. There's a certain percentage, a much smaller percentage, who actually act on these things. And so I also think that is helpful for our audience to know, because some of what's happening here is also this insidious nature of fear that you think then that a larger percentage of these folks are going out and doing things, but it's not the case, right? So yeah, so I just wanted to react to that. I know we're coming down to time and I want to sort of bring us back. I want to think a little bit about the impact of your work. This is where you get to reflect on the impact of the things that you do and you say. When you talk about some of your shows and some of the questions that you investigate and grapple and the things that you invite your audiences to do, I'm interested in what have people said to you afterwards? What have people shared about what they got out of this story that you've put on for them? Do you have any sort of one or two maybe that stand out for you that maybe validate your work for your own personal, you know, reasons?
Thank you. I mean, I sometimes say that, like, you know, making art, making political art is like simultaneously an incredibly ambitious thing to do and a tremendously unambitious thing to do. Like, ambitious in the sense that, like, you're like, oh my God, these ideas, what's going on? Let's explore it. Unambitious, like, what's the actual victory condition? The actual victory condition is that when people go to the bar after the show, they don't immediately start talking about something else. They talk about the show, right? That's the way you know you're winning. That's the beginning of winning. Do you know what I mean? If you really do the job right, they talk about it at dinner with their friend 3 weeks later as well. Do you know what I mean? So it's this weird combination of this crazily ambitious thing you're trying to do and something that's actually very prosaic. And really, like, the best things that in terms of that impact that I get from people is, you know, people, whether they like or dislike my kind of work, will often talk about it being dense and full of stuff. And if they like it, they'll be like, oh my God, it was so dense and rich and I could watch it 4 times. And if they don't like it, they're like, oh my God, it was so dense and I had just got lost and felt like I was drowning. And I go, well, fair enough, mate. You know, you pay your money, you take your choice. Like, that's fine, you know. And in terms of that, I think that density reflects one of the things that we're trying to explore, which is how we take responsibility for a world when it just feels like it's coming at us so fast. And it feels like it's too muchness is such a definitional, you know, constitutive feeling of the world right now. And, you know, people, you know, when people come to me as I'm, you know, luckily, you know, I'm happy to say, as they regularly do, and they'll say, like, oh, there's a way that, like, sitting in that show and the feeling that was going on and the form that you'd found and the story that you were telling, like, it made me think of this. And they'll go, this moment and this moment and this moment, which were all things in their life, or all like things in like global politics. And often then they'll go, you'll know this being an artist. People go, and so what do you think about that? And I'll go, well, mate, I mean, I just like, I literally told you everything I thought through that show, right? That's me. That's me done. Like, that's...
Yeah. I want to bring us to one of our almost last questions in thinking about how we honor our voices, honor our language, our dialects. Thinking about sort of some of those earlier messages that you were receiving around language, whether it's you're in your home and you're speaking Persian, which is very, very special, it's unique, to those moments in the classroom where you were receiving these other messages around your language, don't speak that, you're not allowed, to then even later when you're defending this other person's language background, to this moment right here, right now. What perhaps are you most proud of as it relates to the way you embrace your language, your identity, your culture?
Well, I mean, I think what I'm proud of, and I think this is one of the things that I achieve through the work that I make with my company, is that, you know, the kind of theatre we make is international in scope and what it's about, And it's international in the way it's distributed, in the sense that we tour quite a lot in the continent of North America, right? In US and Canada, tour quite a lot in kind of Australia and Europe. You know, we are lucky that we found an audience, part of which is, you know, relatively, you could say, you know, a section of theatre where you get to move around the world and you get to, you know, make work in all kinds of places. But we're also from somewhere. We're also from somewhere. And where we're from is post-industrial, ethnically diverse Northern England. And the thing is, there is a way of thinking. For me, I think of cosmopolitanism as one of the great virtues. And ease with other people, do you know what I mean? And openness to other people. Being able to find jokes and banter with people who are nothing like you. And I think sometimes, especially in art, because that international art space is quite a socially elite space, right? That's where most of the people who work in it come from. That's where most of the money that funds it comes from, you know, that kind of thing. And there's sometimes amongst those people who are, you know, that kind of more, let's trade in stereotypes, that kind of more elite sort of liberal way of looking at things, they have a model of cosmopolitanism which involves jetting around the world. Do you know what I mean? Which we do, right? You know, my company does our fair share of that, but it involves moving around the world and involves, I think that's a kind of cosmopolitanism that comes from above. But if you kicked around in a city like Bradford or Manchester or Detroit or Sydney or these places, there's a cosmopolitanism of diverse immigrant working class communities, right? Where you grow up on a WhatsApp group with like family on three different continents, and actually like at your, you, do you know what I mean, sister's wedding, there are people from like four different countries who are like her best friends. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's a way in which people from more elite social classes never feel like they come from somewhere. Do you know what I mean? And if you get into those spaces, sometimes you are asked to pretend you don't come from somewhere as well. But I think us and our work and our company comes from somewhere and reaches the world, as opposed to, I don't know, you know, becoming homogenous.
Becoming of the world, perhaps.
Yeah.
When you mentioned that sort of cosmopolitan lifestyle, it would be interesting to know, how do you adapt to, when you go to these different places, do you ever do any rewriting to, you know, oh, I'm in front of this audience where culturally this might hit them a little bit more? Do you ever adjust pieces of the plays depending on where you are?
To be honest with you, like in places that would surprise you, I've adjusted my diction in English, like, because I do have a Northern English accent, right? Like, and that is in, like, weirdly, there are towns in North America where people struggle with that more than they do in Sweden or Germany, which I just find hilarious. Do you know what I mean? But I'm like, fine, you do you. Less so, because when we make our work, we try and, you know, we like, I would put it like this again, to be slightly obnoxious. In the great traditions of English theatre, you are sort of brought up, if you're a political playwright, to want to write the state of the nation play. It's always, you know, I think it's a slightly better idea to try and write the state of the world play. So when you sort of lean into that, do you know what I mean? You're trying to write something a bit bigger anyway.
I know some places do, they take into account this place with this particular history. I'm going to pull that out. It brings
I mean, like, sure, man. I mean, there's like a gag in this show that we've got here at the minute that basically is about where I grew up, which just means something in England, right? Do you know what I mean? It's a way that I can do self-deprecating, like, basically I sort of do a gag about how not glamorous it is, but phrase it in a way that, do you know what I mean? It's like incongruous, right? So like I'm sort of giving, as if something glamorous happens, I tell a very unglamorous story. But if I say that and that happens in Bradford in like thousands of miles, like no one cares. Do you know what I mean? Like no one's heard of the place. Do you know what I mean? So we just basically two words change. Do you know what I mean? But that's, I mean, it doesn't feel like a rewrite to me. It just feels like, it feels like what stand-ups do. Do you know what I mean? It feels like what pop stars do at the beginning of a concert. Like,
Yeah, but it does. It changes it and it feels more like, oh, that's I can relate to that. Wow, it's amazing. Thank you.
This is a podcast about language, so well picked up on that linguistic change.
Yeah. One of the things that we like talking about is actually the name of our show. We Are What We Speak. It's a question. It's a statement. It's any number of things. And I'm wondering, what do you think? Are we what we speak? In your opinion, why or why not? And you can speak personally as well versus we as humans. You could just say me, Javad, is or is not.
Yeah. I think that I am very, still quite influenced by a way of thinking about language that comes out of certain kinds of European philosophy and social theory in largely the 70s and 80s in France. So I would think of language as profoundly constitutive of who we are and the way we engage with the world. It's in a way, it's connected to the point I was making about why theatre is a good place to explore politics, because belief and language is slippery, because belief is slippery and theatre is slippery. Well, language is super slippery as well, and actually one of the loveliest thing anyone ever said about the work I do was a critic writing about this recent play. And he said, there's moments where you feel like you touch reality. And I don't know what exactly he meant by that, but like, I think it's to do with a certain way that writing works in the show, where one of the things that the show is about is the feeling of inconsistency in a technological and post-colonial world. And there's some ways it's possible to write that draw your attention to, that make alive for a moment the way language breaks down. Do you know what I mean? And so I would say there's a very specific way in which we are most fundamentally what we find it impossible to speak.
Wow. It kind of brings me to this thing Fanon said about how we reproduce the ideologies of the languages we speak, and how grappling with that, especially if you yourself cannot say, I own this language, you've been oppressed by the quote unquote dominant power in place, but you've been subjected to this language, and how it can be really hard to come up for air in some ways when you also have to speak that language, but you're told you don't speak it good enough or well enough. There's something that you're saying that really brings me back to that, because of this idea that we are that, or we somehow are a part of that, even if in some ways we fight with what that really means,
Yeah. And certainly Fanon would be one of the people in that. That's the package of stuff. That kind of French influence, kind of psychiatric, psychoanalytic, that's absolutely what I'm driving at, man.
Wow. Thank you so much for being here. I wish we had more time. I totally welcome you back for part two. This has been a fantastic conversation. I thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to say to just take us out? Anything you're hopeful for with your work, with your life going forward?
No, just really, I am. It's a difficult time right now, right? There's not a lot of, like a lot of people, I find myself trapped in a lack of hope, or a difficulty of maintaining hope in the world, but some hope in my personal life. I've had my first child. Well, I haven't had my wife has had our first child. And so we're going to carry on making this work. I'm going to go home, look after my little family. We're going to carry on making this work. And I just hope that if there are folks out there listening to this who feel like I might be part of their community of interest, connect with us, man. There's like a website, there's social media, all that stuff.
Thank you so much. Break a leg with the show tonight.
Really lovely to meet you. Thank you.
Produced in partnership with Ann Arbor District Library.